This is the EWN Radio Network.
She's smart. She's successful. She's an executive. She's an entrepreneur. And she's the chief executive of her story. Who is she? She's you. Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network. Your Power Lunch Hour, keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome to the Power Lunch, sponsored by Enterprise Capital, your business partner for all your small business financing needs. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, along with my handsome co-host, Jay Como.
Welcome back, everyone. We are the wife and husband duo bringing you Women News Talk Radio. We're committed to ensuring women are recognized in the media as equally as men, and as a father of two daughters, as you know, I know the importance of building that foundation for the next generation. And this week, it was a special date night for us. We celebrated Mona Lisa's birthday, and she happens to have a big smile on her face. Why is that, dear?
Two reasons, and I will quote the fabulous Coco Chanel, "The best things in life are free, and the second best things are really expensive." And for first, I have the best husband, kids, and extended family who know how to make you feel like a rock star on your special day. So for that, I'm extremely grateful. But for the second best things in life, yes, they are very expensive. And ladies, I can say for all those women shoe lovers, I'm smiling ear to ear because I have one of those red-soled shoes on my feet. That's right. I was giddy like a kid in a candy store when I opened the box and saw the Christian Louis Vuitton label. So Jay and the kids were so wonderful. I had to memorialize the entire moment. I think, Jay, I just inhaled it. I think it took me 20 minutes just to open the box. It was almost like opening a light blue Tiffany box for jewelry.
Yeah, and you had me and the kids worried a little bit. We thought you were upset. I don't think I've ever seen you savor the smell of a box like you did this one.
Well, honey, it's deserved. And it's a rightful moment in history forever embedded in my brain, opening my first Christian Louis Vuitton box. So yes, it was great and a wonderful day. So thank you to everyone for all your birthday wishes. And we cannot forget our new listeners, welcome to our show. For all you old-timers, God bless you for coming back each week to hear more. Don't forget you can access all of our past episodes and podcasts off our website, www.ewnradionetwork.com/power-lunch. You can also view all of our sister radio shows on the EWN Radio Network.
Don't forget our mobile app. I think we have some problems with Google Pay, so we fixed that bug. You can also find our free mobile apps at the Apple Store and Google Play, sorry. And you can find our podcasts on iTunes. Just look for Mona Lisa's beautiful face on the icon. By finding it, you can search Power Lunch Radio and you'll see that app. Although we love analyzing data, and it's apparent most of you listen via desktop, you can download the show from Blog Talk Radio as well at our website, whatever is easiest for you.
Lastly, we also want you to find us on Twitter. Both Jay and I are on Twitter. I'm at Mona Lisa Como, all one word, and Jay is at Jay_Como. We have a LinkedIn, Google Plus, and Facebook fan page. All of this, again, can be found on our website at www.ewnradionetwork.com.
And we're ready to go. Let's get started with our women headliners in sports.
Well, let's kick off with women's college basketball. This past Tuesday, college women's sports were front and center at the Amalia Arena in Tampa, Florida, for the women's NCAA basketball Final Four. And to no one's surprise, the UConn Huskies faced off with Notre Dame's Fighting Irish women one more time. And at the end, again, no one was surprised. The UConn Huskies took the title championship for the third time in a row, beating Notre Dame 63-53.
Notables for the game are Helena Mosqueda-Lewis and Mariah Jefferson, who each scored 15 points for the UConn Huskies. Brianna Stewart added 15 rebounds and 8 points for UConn. The two-time AP Player of the Year has saved her best game for when the light shined the brightest. She earned Most Outstanding Player of the Final Four honors for the third time, making her the first woman ever to achieve that. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was the only men's player to do it when he played for Wooden's UCLA Bruins. And as you stated, Mona Lisa, it was UConn's third straight title. Coach Ariama and the Huskies have won all of their 10 trips to the national championship game. And I read an article that there was a junior at UConn, and she said winning the championship's not why she went to school, the only reason, but it's the only thing she knows. Freshman, sophomore, junior year. She's not a player. She's a student there. She just knows them winning the championship.
Can you imagine that? And the record for Coach Gino Auremma, well, it is definitely one for the history books. Forbes contributor Elena Glass covered an article on Coach Auremma's success. It's titled "How UConn, Gino Auremma, and Dominate Women's College Basketball." She states, Gino Auremma is not a John Wooden, and he knows it. Roughly 15 years ago, he humbly recalled listening to the legendary UCLA coach talk X's and O's only to later learn that the Wizard of Westwood admired his coaching talent but did not recall their exchange. While Coach Arima does not like comparing men's and women's basketball, he in fact can't stand the comparison on the court, the two coaches have a historic accomplishment together, a record 10 NCAA National Basketball Championships. Arima is undeniably the Wizard of women's basketball. Occasionally, the UConn Huskies, though, are beatable, very rarely, but they have. Last November, Stanford handed them their only loss for the 2014-2015 season, and their national opponent that they just played, Notre Dame, beat them 7 times in the last 5 seasons. But in the national championship games, every time UConn accelerates into another gear, every time they've gone to the finals, all 10 times, they've won.
He's accomplished the feat of 3 straight championships twice, which is fascinating. This is an amazing accomplishment by a pretty humble coach, and he actually bucks any comparison to his team remaining undefeated. In Atlanta's article, he says he knows at some point UConn's historic national champion streak will come to an end. Coach Arima calls the idea of this program being undefeated continuously is ludicrous, and although many commentators are quick to describe UConn's women's basketball team as a dynasty and compare his coaching achievements with the likes of Mike Krzyzewski, whose Duke team just won his 5th national championships, and also he's likened to Phil Jackson and Wooden. Arima continues to shudder these comparisons. I think since 1995, in the last 20 years, we've been as good and as consistent in our sport as anybody else has been in their sport. I never compare our sport to any other sport. I don't compare our team to any other teams, he said.
I think it's great that he's so humble, but it's interesting that he takes such a strong tact when it comes to the comparisons to both men and women's basketball, even to any other coach. UConn does take very good care of this coach, though. After 30 seasons, he's had 917 wins. Arima is the highest-paid coach in women's basketball, in college women's basketball. He is in the second year of a 5-year contract valued at $10.8 million, and that doesn't include the perks or endorsements. This season, he will earn a $2 million, $400,000 base salary, and $1.5 million for institutional speaking engagements and media-related appearances. And he does get an additional $183,000 for his postseason bonus. Well, it's great to hear that coaching a women's sport can be just as lucrative as coaching a male sport. Congratulations once again to the ladies of the University of Connecticut, the Huskies, and Coach Gina Arima. What an amazing win and a legacy. Let's move on from college women's sport. It's April, which means it's Masters seasons. And the Masters tournament, also is known as the U.S. Masters, is one of the 4 major championships in professional golf. Well, it's always scheduled for the first week of April, so very typical to hear about Masters once Easter rolls around. And it is the first of the majors to be played each year. Unlike the other major championships, though, the Masters is held each year at the same location, whereas most majors move around to different golf courses. This one is held at the same location, the Augusta National Golf Club, a private club in the city of Augusta, Georgia. It's also been very controversial because it is a male-only tournament and golf club.
You seem to know more about golf than I do. I don't know much about golf and the traditions they have in the sports, but for instance, since 1949, a green jacket has been awarded to the champion, who must return it to the clubhouse 1 year after the victory. In most instances, the green jacket is only removed from the club grounds by a first-time champion. A golfer who wins the event multiple times uses the same green jacket awarded upon his initial win. The green sports coat is the official attire worn by members of the Augusta National while on the club grounds, so each Masters winner becomes an honorary member of the club. The recipient of the green jacket has it presented to him inside the butler cabin soon after the end of the tournament, which you've seen on TV probably so many times every year.
Yeah.
So winners keep their jacket for the first year after their first victory, then return it to the club to wear whenever they're there. And I'm a connoisseur of fine men's clothing. The jacket is, in my view, while prestigious from a golf perspective, not quite fine men's clothing, or at least something stylistically I'd wear.
Yeah, I couldn't see you. You're a blazer guy, and I couldn't see you wearing one of those. But interesting that they've chosen that color. Still interesting how old their traditions are, that you have to wear that blazer every time you're there. The Masters is known for tradition, and despite the women not being part of the green jacket tradition, part of the Masters tradition is the annual ISPS Handa GWAA Awards dinner, which is hosted every Tuesday before the Masters begins. It's presented by the PGA of America, PGA Tour, and USGA. Well, why do we bring this up? Well, women headliners made this dinner event pretty special this year. The LPGA Tour was heavily represented as well, with Stacey Lewis and Morgan Pressel receiving awards. Stacey Lewis received the Female Player of the Year, and Morgan Pressel received the Charlie Bartlett Award. It's no surprise for anyone that Stacey Lewis won Female Player of the Year last year. 2014 was an outstanding year for her. In fact, 2014 was so great that it has not been replicated by an American golf pro, a female American golf pro, since 1992. She won three of the season's biggest honors in 2014. She won the Moneyless title, the Vare Trophy, and Rolex Player of the Year. She also posted three wins and led the tour with 18 top 10 finishes in 28 events. Stacey Lewis previously won this award for the 2012 season. Last year it was won by NB Park. Morgan Pressel, she received the Charlie Bartlett Award, and that's more of a humanitarian award. It's given to a professional golfer for their unselfish contributions to the betterment of society. Morgan won it for her foundation's work in heightening breast cancer awareness and research to fight the disease. The Morgan Pressel Foundation has raised more than $3.4 million over the last 6 years. Pressel finds herself in an outstanding company with this award. She joins the likes of Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Lorena Ocho, Tiger Woods, Gary Player, Lee Trevino, Ernie Els, and the late Payne Stewart as Bartlett Award honorees. So congratulations to Stacey Lewis for winning Female Player of the Year and Morgan Pressel for the Charlie Bartlett Award. Great job, ladies.
So we're talking about women who play sports. Let's get into an area that is my technical expertise, and there's a great topic out there in the NFL. You rarely see a woman get coverage in the NFL like this past week. Twitter, Facebook, and blogs were ablaze this week as the NFL announced their first female official, Sarah Thomas. She's been officiating for a while. She's been a trailblazer throughout her career. Thomas became the first female to officiate in a Division I-A high school football game in Mississippi. She began officiating college games when she was hired in 2007 by Conference USA. And she officiated the conference championship game in 2010 and 2014. Typically for those championship games, they pick the best officials in the conference for the championship games, right? So they want to have the highest pedigree
right.
People go to the... So that was a testament to her skills. She was the first woman chosen to officiate a bowl game at the Little Caesars Pizza Bowl in 2009. Thomas was twice chosen... Yeah, I had to throw that in there. Thomas was twice chosen to officiate the Senior Bowl and also worked in the United Football League. She officiated training camps and practices and preseason games while in the NFL's development pipeline. This development pipeline basically is programmed for, it's not just for females, it's for aspiring officials to get into the sport. So she participated in that successfully. She first came to the league's attention in 2006 when officiating. Thomas first came to the league's attention in 2006 when a scout, so this is like player scouts, but these guys actually scout officials. So she actually got onto the NFL's radar screen when a scout noticed her top-notch abilities. And so at the time, she really wasn't thinking about having an officiating career with two young children and a third. But the scout called her after the game and asked if she was interested in taking the next official step, officiating step, and she said yes. So the scout put her in touch with Jerry Austin, a former NFL official, who was Conference USA's officiating coordinator. And that's really what got it started. When Austin hired her, he used Thomas's initials at first because Austin hadn't yet told the conference commissioner that he had just hired a female official. So once the announcement was public,
wow.
Thomas later learned four women applied for officiating jobs that afternoon, something no woman has ever done before. So he kind of had to keep it on the down low.
So he actually had to hide that.
Until it was official. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a trailblazer.
Really, I mean, it's sad, but it shows if she definitely broke through those glass ceilings. Well, I read some of the commentary and questions posed to her. And like you said, Jay, it was definitely went viral this week. At first, I saw the article. There were only a few of the big networks that were making any comments, predominantly the sports networks. And then the major cable news and other network news started to pick up on the story as well. But what was interesting, some of the lame questions that were posed and written about her taking on this wonderful job, basically something that she's been doing her whole career. So one of the interviews that I had watched was ESPN Radio. They asked her about whether or not she was worried about her safety. I think that's a little interesting because she's on a field with really big guys who are running around. Again, this is what this woman has been doing her whole career, so interesting that they would bring it up now. But was she worried about getting run over? So the ESPN radio host said, you know, there's been some articles written about you and questions on whether or not you can handle it. It's pretty rough out there. And she was really matter-of-fact. She didn't, you know, add any more fuel to it. She just said, you know what, I'm good. I'm a big girl, which I loved. Another article that I read on her position was written in Fortune. That was just yesterday. And it was titled, Will Appointing the First Female Ref Help Clean Up the NFL's Reputation? I don't know why, but that one just irritated me because I don't think they meant it to be intentional, but the headliner alone insinuated or inferred that Thomas got the job more for kind of checking the box or filling a quota and not because she had a career leading up to it. And that's the part that just really annoyed me. But you read up on her. She's had a career kind of leading up all into this.
Yeah, she decided to be an official early on. Worked her way into college, as you heard, when she got the announcement for Conference USA. Put in several years there, a kind of normal tenure for being in a college conference before getting the nod to the NFL. And frankly, the National Football League has been grooming her as well. It's all been a natural, orderly transition that looks just as much like any of her male counterparts. She's put as much time in Conference USA and, as mentioned, 2010, 2014, got the nod to do the bowl games, which suggests the high performance. And so there's nothing really quota-driven here. For the last 2 years, she's been in the league's developmental program, as we mentioned earlier. Dean Blandino, the NFL's VP of officiating, when asked about the new appointment of Sarah Thomas, states, "She's a former athlete. She's comfortable on the football field. She doesn't back down." Blandino and Thomas have talked several times over the years about the additional scrutiny and attention she'll receive. In essence, the NFL was preparing for the media attention regarding her appointment, sort of the way it was before the Ray Rice scandals were in the headlines.
See, so that's interesting. So I don't think enough people, which is surprising at this day and age, that less journalists and news commentators are actually doing enough background. And to your point, Jay, you looked up. There was no special treatment here. She actually has been groomed. She's been in the pipeline. There has been criticism that this is a stunt, despite how long she's been working with the NFL. One of the ones that really got on my nerves was Jacksonville Jaguars defensive tackle Sendarek Marks. He compared the NFL hiring of Thomas to the drafting of Michael Sam a year ago, when Michael Sam became the first openly gay player drafted. I was boggled when I read his comment, but I'll let our listeners judge for themselves. Here's his direct quote. "For women, I think it's great," he told TMZ.com. "Ain't nothing wrong with it, especially as long as she knows what she's doing. But it's just like the Michael Sam situation. If he wasn't gay, he would have gone undrafted. Instead, the league drafts him because I think they are trying to monopolize every aspect of the world. You know, the same thing with the female ref. For the league, it's great publicity. The NFL is still about monopolizing every opportunity." So, end of quote. So thank you, Mr. Marks, for your comment. But dude, shut up. The NFL, this cleaning up of their image has nothing to do with Sarah Thomas. I personally don't believe it, because the fact that she's been in the pipeline for so long, and I don't see this as a window dressing. I personally am very passionate about it, because I think it's insulting to Sarah and other women officials who are in the pipeline, who are working. They're not doing it so they can hit a quota or be trailblazers. This is something that they want to do, and they're good at it, if not great, and hence them getting promoted to these positions. So it's highly demeaning for him to make that comment. He should first do some research before he opens his mouth about this.
A little heated there, so tell us what you really think. And to finish his entire quote, where he says, "I hope it works for her." Marks is currently recovering from a torn ACL he suffered from the final game of last season, so maybe he's got too much time on his hand.
Well, I hope it works out for him, too. I mean, that's great. So he has a torn ACL, and he's going to take shots at somebody who's coming into the league and promoting her career. Very disappointing. Very proud of the fact that the NFL has promoted her, that Sarah Thomas is moving her career forward. Really disappointed that the media has to jump to the conclusions that this is window dressing and not take a step back and really look at what this woman has done to move her career forward.
And I think we'll need to go to a break before you say something we need to bleep out. What do we have when we return, Mona Lisa?
You're right. I should calm down there. Well, we always have our women politicians, our women in business, our women entrepreneurs that we'll talk about when we get back. The women on the $20 bill? Yes, it looks like it might happen. More when we return.
Are you an entrepreneur, coach, or consultant who is tired of constantly searching for the next client? Are you ready to get your expertise out of your head, into the world, and packaged into a profitable online course that delivers a steady stream of your perfect ideal clients to your door and a steady, predictable source of revenue? Hi, this is Janine Blackwell, creator of Create Six Figure Courses Virtual Bootcamp. And I've created my own seven-figure courses, and I've walked hundreds of experts like you through the step-by-step of creating and launching a profitable online course. I'd like to invite you to a free online training I'm hosting for you called The 7 Steps to Creating and Launching Your Profitable Online Course. I'm going to show you exactly how to create your course, market your course, and automate delivery of it so you can get your course up and running fast and have it work for you 24/7. You can grab your spot for this free training at www.createmyonlinecourse.com. So join me at www.createmyonlinecourse.com.
Did you know banks decline more commercial loans than they approve? In fact, national banks approve less than 20% of all business loans submitted. And that doesn't include the loans that don't even qualify. But at Interpares Capital, we are here to overcome those odds. We are a nationally recognized commercial brokerage firm with access to thousands of public and private lending institutions. That means we have more options to finance you than your bank does. Whether you are a startup or in need of debt refinancing or growth capital, we can help. We do the heavy lifting so you can focus on running your business. Contact us today for a free consultation with one of our business advisors at 855-365-1930. At Interpares Capital, we are your business partner in finance.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.
Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network, your Power Lunch Hour keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome back to the Power Lunch, sponsored by Interpares Capital, your one stop for all your women entrepreneur financing needs. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, joined by my date night co-host, Jay Como.
And let us now move to the sport of politics and the most powerful woman in the world, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, and undoubtedly the biggest player in Europe and the world, has made headlines again. We pulled this story to discuss because it's a pretty powerful headline. Newsweek featured a story on Angela Merkel titled, Stopping Putin, Can Merkel Succeed Without Force? Folks, let's now just to digest how far we've come on the global front for women leaders. We're talking about facing off against Putin.
Yeah, you're right, Jay. And it was amazing because I think we take for granted how far we've come in this world. There's so much talk here in the United States about equality and women moving ahead. But when you look farther beyond our borders and you see what's happening on the global front, I still think that that's something we should celebrate. Well, Angela Merkel, the article by Ulrich Speck, was written on April 2nd in Newsweek magazines, to what Jay had stated, was actually a fairly well-done article about how she's actually progressed along with Germany to really become a powerhouse. Now, to remember, Germany has become a leader in the Ukraine crisis for three primary reasons. First, German power has grown since the country's reunification in 1990. It not only has the biggest economy and the largest population in the EU, but geographically, if you look at the map, it's literally the heart of Europe, and it's deeply embedded in the EU structures. Well, Angela Merkel has been in office since 2005. She's not shown a great desire to engage in foreign policy leadership in the past, especially when you had the likes of Bush in office when she came to power. But she tended to follow the mainstream on most of the world leaders were following. She wasn't, in the past few years, especially during President Obama's administration, surprisingly, she's actually taken a bigger lead in the international front. Now, one important foreign policy issue that she has played a leading role was the management of the slow and difficult process of integrating the Western Balkans into the EU, and she did that surprisingly, not to very many people's knowledge. She did that behind the scene. And when Merkel did use Germany's power, it was in most cases to apply the brakes on initiatives of others, such as the NATO-led military intervention in Libya or France's efforts to build a coalition to stop the civil war in Syria. Well, since 1990, Germany has moved away from being a frontline state to becoming a country surrounded on all sides by friends. And if Russia was to change its character, it returns to an imperialistic attitude and challenge the status quo, well, then the entire geopolitical order to the East Germany would be at risk. And the personal dimension for Merkel, she grew up in East Germany, she speaks Russian, she's actually not as close, you would think, because the former German presidents have been close with the Russian presidents before. That's not something that she actually sees as important, and a lot of it credited to the fact that because she was brought up in East Germany. Well, her stance on military aspects of the crisis also points out other motives in terms of what she's planning on doing with Russia. One of them appears to be domestic. A large majority of Germans tend to reject the use of military power as a foreign policy tool. It has to do with the fact that the post-Cold War Germany after World War II, they don't have an army, they were not allowed to have one, and Germans in general, having lived there, don't like war at all. She's been branded as a diplomat to really take that to the next level. It's actually Merkel's quiet diplomacy that is forcing Putin and is actually playing the strongest force in Europe on whether or not Putin will step up and cross her. Because if there's one thing that's clear, he's not worried about the United States, he doesn't care about France, but he does know that Angela means business.
She really became the prominence, or Germany flexed its fiscal muscles during the crisis and has held the European Union together. So it's really off the back of her as a leader and Germany's strength fiscally as well. So she gets dual credit for being the most powerful woman in Europe and in the world, and not just the hoods that stand up to Putin, but also keeping things online fiscally.
The article doesn't focus on that, but you are right. One of the reasons why Angela does have so much, well, yeah, that you are. The reason why they do have so much power and influence is, of course, their economy, and definitely does give them the ability to squeeze out any of the naysayers. And Putin does need to get along with them from an economic perspective and a geopolitical. Very interesting article. We bring it up because she is the most powerful woman in the world, and to see a headline where you're having a woman countering one of the most feared dictators in the world for this generation, I think is something to applaud. A little geeky, but something we still think we should bring to you. We're going to bring it back to the United States, where much focus was on the nuclear accord. So for politics in the United States, every news coverage is about the nuclear accord deal with Iran, which was announced this past week. Fortunately, many women politicians also made the headlines on this topic, both those who are elected and those who are hoping to run for president. The nuclear accord with Iran expectedly had both support and criticism along party lines. Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State and presumed candidate for the Democratic presidential ticket, called the framework an important step, quote, while cautioning that the devil is in the details. She also went on to state the onus is on Iran and the bar must be set high. Well, this is interesting because Clinton also helped lay the foundation for the diplomacy with Iran when she was President Barack Obama's first Secretary of State. She also continued to state there is much to do and much more to say in the months ahead, but for now, diplomacy deserves a chance to succeed.
So having any discussions around Iran having any potential to nuclear power, be it just for their civil power development, as they say, it's not a good deal, yet she claims it is a good deal. There's risk this thing could go south with our upcoming elections, right?
It definitely could, but she's definitely taking party lines. Carly Fiorina, not surprisingly, she is the presumed woman candidate for the Republican Party. She expectedly took a different tone. The former HP executive publicly denounced the deal at a discussion at the Center for Strategic and International Studies this past week. Fiorina stated, quote, "The reason I say that this is a bad deal is because we've been sending signals to Iran and to everyone else in the world that bad behavior will be rewarded. Why do I say that? Think about Iran's behavior over the decades. Iran has had a strategy to destabilize the Middle East throughout their proxies. Iran has had a strategy to gain a nuclear weapon. Iran has had a strategy to stonewall every inspection regime that has been put in place. And Iran has had a strategy to stonewall every negotiating effort. And we have rewarded all of that." Jay, not surprisingly, Carly Fiorina is for it, but I think some of the context of what she presents in terms of why it's a bad deal, given the history of Iran, is somewhat fair.
Right, and it's true. We have rewarded them again and again and again, and continue to be flexible, and they're not doing the right things. We're not being the big police of the world, and we're basically giving in by being flexible. An article last week in the Wall Street Journal indicated that not everyone is standing alongside the Democratic Party, you know, following party lines, and the title of the article was "Iran Deal Fuels Rift in Jewish Democrat Alliance."
We both read that article, and it what I like, front page, and it was above the fold, which means it definitely was a prominent featured article. It highlighted a growing rift between the Jewish Democratic community, which is unhappy with the discussions with Iran to date, not surprisingly, as well as the lack of support for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Last week, a group of Jewish Democratic House members met with White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough. They cautioned the White House that for them to help sell a very unpopular Iranian nuclear deal to their Jewish constituents, that President Obama must do more to increase his popularity among the Jewish Democratic base.
And the Democratic Congresswoman out of New York, Nita Lowey, who attended the meeting, made an even more pointed comment discussed in an interview after meeting with McDonough. She states, "I was extremely disturbed by some of the overheated rhetoric that came out of the administration following the Israeli election. I conveyed directly to the White House that it's time to dial back the temperature and affirm as well our strength and affirm and strengthen the U.S.-Israeli relationship." So here you've got, and by the way, she's a very well-decorated Democratic congresswoman from New York. She typically wins her elections with 60-70% of the vote, so she's a powerhouse. She actually, kind of interesting tie to Hillary, she was a strong contender for the Senate seat 10, 14 years ago when Hillary ran for the Senate out of New York. Had Hillary not discussed her options to run for that seat. The conventional wisdom in those days said Nita Lowry was the absolute front runner. When Hillary ran, chose to run, she backed off and said she was going to stay put. Thought about being appointed to the seat when Hillary left it, but she chose not to as well. So she's staying put as a congresswoman and flexing her muscle. Absolutely.
Well, I think that's very interesting that we're starting to see a little bit of that rift. Very impressed to see that Nita Lowry is actually representing her constituents and just not going along with what is the trend in either party. And we've seen that both on the Republican and the Democrat side. Cantor, you know, strayed too far away from what his constituents wanted and was going too far along with the National Party, and his constituents paid him back by not reelecting him. Congratulations to Nita for knowing who actually put her into office. We've wrapped up our politics for this week. When we get back, when we return, we're going to talk about our women trailblazers on the business and entrepreneur front, and we're also going to talk about, as I had stated before, the $20 bill. Yes, folks, is it time to have a woman's face on one of our bills? More when we return.
Hi, I'm Sandra Yancey, founder and CEO of eWomen Network. One of my mottos for business owners is, you can't do it alone. Whether you're in the startup stage of your business or you're scaling, you can't grow without relationships to provide support, wisdom, and new customers. eWomen Network is your home to connect with other women entrepreneurs who've been where you are or are experiencing the same challenges. We have chapters across the U.S. and Canada that have monthly events featuring our trademarked process called Accelerated Networking to ensure you get the contacts, resources, and leads you need to grow your business. And once you become a member, you get many benefits, including 2 one-on-one coaching sessions, unlimited access to our membership database, your own personal profile page, and discounts on products and services with our business partners such as UPS and American Express Open. Join the eWomen Network community and let us help you live your dream. For details, visit eWomenNetwork.com.
Did you know banks decline more commercial loans than they approve? In fact, national banks approve less than 20% of all business loans submitted. And that doesn't include the loans that don't even qualify. But at InterParis Capital, we are here to overcome those odds. We are a nationally recognized commercial brokerage firm with access to thousands of public and private lending institutions. That means we have more options to finance you than your bank does, whether you are a startup or in need of debt refinancing or growth capital. We can help. We do the heavy lifting so you can focus on running your business. Contact us today for a free consultation with one of our business advisors at 855-365-1930. At InterParis Capital, we are your business partner in finance.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.
She's smart. She's successful. She's an executive. She's an entrepreneur. And she's the chief executive of her story. Who is she? She's you. Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network, your Power Lunch Hour keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome back to the Power Lunch, sponsored by InterParis Capital, a business focused on financing other businesses. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, joined by this handsome co-host, Jay Como.
And focusing on social media, let me put a quick plug out there to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and our new LinkedIn page. You can find all of our links on our website, www.ewnradionetwork.com, and go to the Power Lunch Radio page.
Well, next up, we're covering women in business. We love, love, love this segment because women building things is critical for empowerment for women financially, and it's also very great for our economy. The data tells the story of the gap that we must close for this generation and future ones. Women are half the population, but not even close to equal footing on the business ownership standpoint. NABO, or the National Association of Women Business Owners, is a lobbyist group focused on giving resources to women business owners. It touts the benefits of focusing on women entrepreneurs, and I bring this up so that we can always focus on why we should become women entrepreneurs. More than 9.1 million firms are owned by women, which employs nearly 7.9 million people in the U.S., and it generates, as of 2014, $1.4 trillion in sales. Women-owned firms, which are ownership of at least 50% or more, account for 30% of all privately held firms and contribute 14% of employment and 11% of revenues. So imagine if we were able to improve those odds, but there would be a definitive increase in the GDP for the United States if we could make an increase on women business owners. And Jay, you've got some interesting articles on women entrepreneurs that were highlighted this past week.
So I don't know if Investopedia was a site that was available before Wikipedia, but it's effectively the financial investment site for technical terms. It's the wiki of finance, if you will. I know I used it during grad school. I wanted to know what net interest income was. Oh, yeah. You can get formulas for calculating. There are certain formulas like return on equity and other kind of technical arcane sort of topics. So I've always known the site where I've gone and needed to understand ratios and formulas. And now that it looks like, and I don't know how long they've been doing this, but it looks like there's now blogging on the site. And so Christina Zuki, who's a CFA, posted a site just recently, and the title of posted a blog rather on the site. And the title is The 10 Most Successful Women Entrepreneurs of the Decade. So I'll give a quick rundown on who she deemed as the 10 most successful entrepreneurs for the last 10 years. And in real estate, healthcare, and technology, she has Zhang Xin, co-founder of Soho China, which is a real estate development firm in China that went public in 2007. There's Kiran Mazumdar Shah, founder of Biocom, an Indian biopharma company. They actually had $1 billion in valuation on their first day of trading. Their IPO was 2004. There's Willy Dai, co-founder of Marvel Technology Group Limited, and she is the only female founder of a semiconductor firm. Moving into entertainment and media, there's Beyoncé, the singer and songwriter, who started out as Destiny's Child back in the mid-90s. Right. And there's Oprah, the media mogul, who needs no introduction. And Arianna Huffington is on there. Got an interesting background. I mean, we all know her for the Huffington Post and the big sale to AOL, but before that, she unsuccessfully ran for governor during the recall election in the race where Arnold Schwarzenegger eventually won, and was also married to a Republican congressman who was a billionaire and was actually more right of center before she turned left of center in the last 10-15 years. Closing out the list for fashion and beauty, we've talked about Tory Burch in the past, and she's CEO of Tory Burch, the U.S.-based clothing fashion line that she launched in 2004. There is Sarah Blakely, inventor of Spanx, your favorite company out there, and started that company with $5,000. That's right. They're changing they're diversifying their product. There's Leslie Blodgett, CEO of Bare Essentials, and this is a mineral-based makeup company, and she took over in 94, and do most of their distribution through QVC now, but she did a turnaround there for them. And then lastly, there's Katie Rodan and Kathy Fields, co-founded Rodan and Fields, makers of Proactive. So they felt so strongly about eradicating acne in all ages that they came together to develop a flagship product in 1995 to fight acne, and they have an estimated sales now of $800 million annually. So they fought a good cause, and they've certainly wrung some good sales figures out of it as well. Your thoughts on the
list? Let's break it down from the top. So on the real estate healthcare and technology gurus, I applaud Christina Zuki for putting the list together. I do think there were a couple that should have made the list. First, start with who did make her list, Zhang Xin. She's worth $4 billion, so she definitely should have made the list. She co-founded her real estate development company in China with her husband back in 1995. So they took about 12 years before they went public. And their net worth only continues to grow with obviously the expansion of China. Both her and her husband, Zhang Xin, and her husband, they own 64% of the company. And that has put their net worth at $4 billion already. So Jay, imagine they own 64% and it's just growing. I honestly do perceive that their billions will continue to grow. Willy Dai, the co-founder of Marvel, I'll just jump down to her. She's an interesting one. She has made so many lists, whether it's the Forbes or the Fortune list. She's, of course, the co-founder of a semiconductor company. She started it in 1995, and she single-handedly helped rise that semiconductor company to the top of the world based on her partnership. And she's been a driving force in expanding access to technology to the developing world. She's an ambassador between the U.S. and China, more from the business standpoint. She's also considered one of the 420th most wealthiest person in China. Her estimated wealth right now is worth $730 million. She was listed as the 97th most powerful woman in the world by Forbes. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that she owns a good portion of her company as well. But somebody who didn't make the list that I thought should have was two ladies, for at least for healthcare and for technology. Judith Faulkner, she's the founder of Epic Systems, one of the biggest healthcare systems in the world. She founded that company. She's worth $3 billion, so I think she should have made the list. And Wu Yajun, she's 50 years old. She co-founded Longfor Properties in China. She's also one of the most wealthiest women in the world, and she's worth $3 billion as well. Moving down to entertainment and media, Jay, no surprise, Beyonce. A little surprised that she's only worth $115 million, though.
I mean, think about it. She's worth $100. She doesn't produce anything. That's all on her skills. So that wealth is basically all on people wanting to listen and see
That's
her
fair.
And buy her albums and go to her concerts. So, I mean, she did it all around, which is what I'm trying to say. I actually mean that to be a positive.
You know, especially her concerts have really grown her net worth. She was named in Forbes as the number one on the Forbes celebrity list, not for her money, but for her influence. Oprah Winfrey, she was the only female African-American billionaire. We now have the Nigerian, I think she's the head of the oil companies there. Oprah continues to grow her net worth. She's 60 years old and she's at $3 billion. Not surprised that she is continuing to grow that, but her own network, I think, is starting to take some heat. I did hear a rumor that they were looking at pulling out Harpo Industries, but I think, you know, there's still been some work on whether they can pull that network up to better ratings. Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of Huffington Post. She has an interesting, to your point, they only have her net worth at $50 million. She always talks about her first husband. She was married to Michael Huffington? When they got married, she was, to your point, she was known for being extremely conservative. Right, Michael Huffington, she married him in 1985. She met him in 1985 and married him a year later in 1986. He ran for the Republican seat in 1992, which he won. So he won the U.S. House of Reps by a significant margin, 92. In 94, he almost lost the race for the U.S. Senate seat to incumbent Dianne Feinstein. And then in 1998, which I did not know this, he actually declared that he was bisexual. He went publicly and said, in 1985, in my Houston house, I did sit down with Arianna and told her that I dated both men and women and she should be aware of it. So this is good news that it's not an issue for her. So it came out publicly that he was bisexual. The couple, you know, actually divorced back in 1997. And I forgot this part about her as well. I remember back in the day when we were still living in California, I forgot that she challenged, and she was pretty vocal about challenging Arnold Schwarzenegger at the time. Do you remember how very visceral that she was known for making a lot of personal and kind of biting comments?
She just got done publishing the book Pigs at the Trough, kind of going after politicians and corporate America, was making her move from right to left, and what you write was all over the news. And it's interesting that she lost that race, the gubernatorial race, but then started the Huffington Post 2 years later, so
right.
It looks like it was a pretty darn good consolation prize.
She's done phenomenal, and she continues to do the speaker circuit, where I think that she's most influential is definitely her name is on the Huffington Post itself, but I've personally seen her, I've read her book, I think she does a phenomenal job on that standpoint, so not surprised to see her as one of the most successful entrepreneurs of the decade. Moving down to fashion and beauty, Tory Burch, $1 billion, who can make $1 billion off a flat. You know, look at Sarah Blakely, she made $1 billion, or became a billionaire over making bodywear. Both women have done quite a bit to catapult their career in the last decade. And what was interesting about Sarah Blakely is she used to be known as the world's youngest self-made billionaire, and she was recently ousted by someone that we've reported on. Jay, do you know who?
Is that the medical industry company where
Serrano.
It helps your blood test? Serrano, yeah.
Yeah. So they only need to prick your finger for blood rather than taking a whole vial out of your veins. And so she used to be known for that. But both of these women, Tory Burch and Sarah Blakely, have done quite a bit to take the fashion industry to the next level. Miuccia Prada didn't make the list. She's an older trailblazer on the front. I was surprised that she didn't make the fashion beauty entrepreneur list, you know, the top 10 for the last 10 years. She's 65 years old. She's actually one of the richest women in the world. She's worth $10 billion because she owns the entire House of Prada. So it was a great article. I do think that there were a couple of women that were left off the list, but I do think when they rewrite this list in literally a couple years, there's going to be some great new names like Elizabeth Theranos that will make it. And Michelle Phan, who we talked about last week. There's definitely going to be some new movers and shakers in the female entrepreneurial space. And while we're on that, there's also something else we wanted before we go to break. There's this great new called Code with Carly. So Carly Kloss is a model and entrepreneur. She's an entrepreneur of Carly's Cookies. She's paving the way for young women to get a head start with Coding for Carly Scholarship. And if you've not heard about it, it just came out, I think yesterday, and there's quite a bit of tweeting it out to help promote it to get out a lot of publicity out there. If you're a parent, grandparent, or teacher that knows young ladies who have the passion for STEM or just have the potential, check out the website at flatironschool.com and look for the Code with Carly Scholarship. It's open for teenagers 13 to 18, held in New York City along with five other cities, and the 20 scholarships is a fully paid tuition scholarship to attend the Code for Carly School. It's a great resume building for college applications, and it's going to be great exposure for the young ladies that actually get to take part of it. Want to make sure that we get that out there. Please retweet this out and send this out to family members that you know. Again, it's the Carly Kloss Making Coding for Girls So Cool. It's the Coding for Carly Scholarship, and you'll find that on our website and on our Facebook and Twitter. Jay, I think we should go to break.
We should as well. So what will we be talking about in our last segment? Give us a little flavor.
The face of our new $20 bill. It could be a woman, and it's more when we return.
I'm looking for a certain kind of woman, and I think you know her. She's an entrepreneur that is highly connected, successful, significant in her own industry, and considered the go-to woman in her community. She's received so much from so many women in business, she's ready to give back to others on their journey, lifting as she climbs. Hi, this is Sandra Yancey, and I'm the founder and CEO of eWomen Network. I'm looking to connect with the woman I've just described who lives in your community so that we might have a conversation about how eWomen Network's proven success system can provide her a platform to elevate her success and ability to support women in business. Our international community of managing directors are influencing the speed of success for women in business around the world. If that sounds like something that you want to be part of or know someone we should talk with, send an email to managingdirector@ewomennetwork.com. That's managingdirector@ewomennetwork.com. And let's start the conversation.
Did you know banks decline more commercial loans than they approve? In fact, national banks approve less than 20% of all business loans submitted. And that doesn't include the loans that don't even qualify. But at InterParis Capital, we are here to overcome those odds. We are a nationally recognized commercial brokerage firm with access to thousands of public and private lending institutions. That means we have more options to finance you than your bank does, whether you are a startup or in need of debt refinancing or growth capital, we can help. We do the heavy lifting so you can focus on running your business. Contact us today for a free consultation with one of our business advisors at 855-365-1930. At InterParis Capital, we are your business partner in finance.
You're connected to the EWN Radio Network.
Welcome to the Power Lunch on EWN Radio Network, your Power Lunch Hour keeping you informed of women in the headlines and making their own news. And now here's your host, Mona Lisa Como.
Welcome back to the Power Lunch, sponsored by InterParis Capital. If you need to finance your startup or expand an existing business, contact the advisors at InterParis Capital today. I'm your host, Mona Lisa Como, with my handsome co-host, Jay Como.
Some would think that I co-host the show with you for entrepreneurial reasons, maybe even altruistic reasons. I'm only here to listen to you introduce me.
Well, did you hear we're changing the face of the $20 bill?
I didn't even know that was an option.
Well, yes, it is. And apparently it's a movement that's been catching momentum for a while in preparation for 2020. Well, why the year 2020, you ask? The year 2020 marks the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment that granted women the right to vote. Yes, we've had less than 100 years where women could vote in this country. Well, a group called Women on 20s is a nonprofit organization that was created for the specific reason to try to urge President Obama to change and to approve changing the face of the $20 bill. Well, Jay, you've worked at the Federal Reserve back in the day when you were actually handling physical money. This isn't a small effort, correct?
No, it's not. In fact, there are rules who can be on paper currency. Established in 1929 by the U.S. Code Title 31, Section 514, you have to have been deceased for at least 2 years to have your portrait on government securities, and you have to
That's
be
nice.
Fairly recognizable to the general public. And the portraits haven't changed, by the way, since 1929.
Okay.
The Secretary of Treasury may order new portraits and designs shown on the United States currency. But unless specified by an act of Congress, the Secretary generally has the final approval, and this is done with the advice of the BEP, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, as well as the Commission of Fine Arts, as they do, the Government Commission of Fine Arts, they do all of the design review. Lawmakers may order a change of the portrait or new denomination by an act of Congress as well.
So that's pretty geeky. I think you're showing off.
I am kind of geeky, but I'll show off a little bit more. According to the Department of the Treasury, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, quote, currency is designed with a purpose. When redesigning a note, designers strive to convey a dignified image that reflects the strength of the American economy, retain familiar characteristics that identify a note as American currency, incorporate the latest anti-counterfeiting features, and consider how details such as outline, tone, and shading will translate when engraved and printed on intaglio press, and end quote. And so, by the way, the anti-counterfeiting features, this is something that is constantly moving and advancing, and it doesn't seem like there would be a lot of anti-counterfeiting going on in bills, but it is. The central government, the Federal Reserve, and the BEP are on the cutting edge of fighting against counterfeits. And having formerly been involved with the Federal Reserve, the central bank, I'm very aware of how much effort they put into it.
You're definitely a geek. And for my husband, actually used to literally physical vaults where you don't really think about it, you know, cording off pallets of a lot about how this stuff gets in and out. But I would assume that changing a currency just from an operational perspective, or a new currency and taking out of the old, is definitely anything to do.
So I am a geek, and you must really appreciate and love me for my brain, because clearly can't be for my look. It's actually, once you get the policy approved and you go through everything that I mentioned previously, where the design review, the Fine Arts Commission, and the BEP, they all come to decide to do it. Once you get there, it's actually not too hard. It's really as simple as producing this new bill and putting it out into circulation. And what happens is the BEP decides which Federal Reserve banks to release the notes to. And then as banks in those Reserve Bank districts put in money orders for their retail branches, they get the new bills, brand new bills. And so what happens is they also take bills in, right, from their all of the branch networks, from their day's activities. They bundle that up. And they send it back to the Federal Reserve, where the Federal Reserve takes the used bills and either refurbishes them and puts them back in their vault for subsequent redistribution, or they take them out. They shred them. They take them out of circulation. Now, whenever they do this, they account for it. It has to be highly managed, and it is. But they shred the currency. Now, they'll do this, by the way. So, for example, if they were going to change the old 20s, I suspect they'd say, okay, shred all Andrew Jackson 20s going forward. And they would do that, right? As they get them in, they'd shred them. But they can also shred them under, you know, no normal decree, just if the soil content is too high, or if there's any kind of degradation to the bill, if the fitness isn't in the right spot, they will shred that currency. They'll report it to say, you know, because they have to keep track of M1 and M2, the money supply, and then the BEP will know we've got X amount of actual paper bills shredded, and if we want to keep the monetary supply rate at the same rate, we'll need to produce some more. So the actual part of taking it out of circulation isn't so tough, because most bills get recirculated to the Federal Reserve, and they can take it out via shredding it.
All right, well, so you're officially a nerd, but a very handsome one on that. Are you surprised that there's a focus on Andrew Jackson now? I think you and I had talked about this originally, and I guess there's a question, why not the one, why not the five? But why pick on Andrew Jackson, you know, in terms of replacing him? Because the rules are that you have to, one, be dead, clearly, and the second one, you have to be highly recognizable, which, if you ask me, I didn't know Jackson's. I only know Jackson's face because it's on the $20 bill.
Well, he was proclaimed the self-made man. He's also a pretty rough dude. He doesn't have, and I'm no historian, but he's, from what I've read over the years, and I've got an impressive library that I don't mind bragging about.
Yes, he did.
Including many books on presidents. He's not known as a real nice guy. And he's got some social flaws, I think. And I think some of his policies were a little dated and unsuccessful. So I'm not surprised that they would look to strike him. I'm just wondering why, you know, why would it be on a 20 and not 100?
Well, then again, what would you call a Benji, right? Because you'd have to change that name as well. The Women on 20s organization has gained the headlines this past week. As we had said, they're gaining popularity. They've been tweeting out their survey to just about anybody who, in terms of who women should think and men should be on the list of final contenders. 256,000 people have voted. It was 15 contenders in a robust 5-week primary round that ended this past Sunday. Voters selected the final four. That voters selected was Eleanor Roosevelt, Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, and Wilma Mankiller. That's right, Wilma Mankiller. You've not heard about her? Because I've not heard about her either. The first female chief of the Cherokee Nation. The competition originally started with 100 women names. The final ballot is still open today. It's going to run till May 1st. They've not set up an official cutoff date, but they'll decide in the next couple of weeks if they have enough of votes in, as stated by Barbara O. Howard, from the founder of Women on 20s. Jay, who are you thinking? I mean, are you surprised by the last four? Did you think anybody else should have made it? Eleanor Roosevelt, Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, Wilma Mankiller, and does it fit the criteria set forth by Congress in terms of whose face can be on there?
I don't know. It's such a controversial topic, really, with race relations in the U.S. right now. You almost want to say, looking at Harriet Tubman and Rosa Parks, I mean, on the one hand, do they reflect what's going on now? And I think there's probably an argument that it does. They do. Eleanor Roosevelt, not surprised at all by that. Like you, I didn't know who Wilma Mankiller was either. And she's, I guess you sort of half wonder, is that the right name? I mean, Mankiller. Basically, we're gonna kill Andrew Jackson from the $20 bill. And why not let Wilma do it?
That Mankiller. Well, I mean, think about replacing a Benji with a Mankiller, right? Okay, can you hand me a Mankiller?
Actually,
I mean, that's a horrible...
No. Stereotypically speaking, of course, but you've just justified why it should be on the $100 bill. It might be sufficient to be the 100 is the Mankiller. It's killing in your wallet.
Is the Mankiller?
Not necessarily.
That's funny. I never thought about it that way.
So that could be good. But you know, that Mankiller, that's a technical term. She is Cherokee, the head of the Cherokee Nation for 10 years. But that her last name is derived by actual rank in the Cherokee Nation. So that is very much a technical term.
Who do you think should be, if it's down to the final four? I've already voted, so I'll tell you who I voted.
I'm not sure that I'm being dishonest when I say I'd vote for Mankiller.
Well, I chose Eleanor Roosevelt, and so I'm going to be a little bit more expected on this. First, let me say I'm surprised, in fairness, that Susan B. Anthony didn't make the cut. And I find that so ironic. She made the cut for the coins. And no, that's not true. We have the Sacagawea coin, but we also have the Susan B. Anthony coins. So I truly believe that she should have been included minimally because she made the cut for being on the list for women or faces to be on the coins. Also, frankly, since the whole point is to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the women's right to vote, it was Susan B. Anthony, along with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Alice Paul, that were the three women suffragists that were the leaders of the movement to ensure that we had the right to vote. So ironic that the three women who were responsible and what we're celebrating in 2020 didn't at least minimally get an honorable mention, still make the final four despite what everybody else is voting.
And I agree, actually. Those are all very good suggestions. I don't know, tongue-in-cheek, but was the lack of success for the Susan B. Anthony coin maybe a precursor to her not getting on the currency because it was strike one and you don't want to have strike two? I don't know really if that's the case, but the circulation of that coin didn't go over so well. But so you picked Eleanor Roosevelt, so why?
For several reasons. But first and foremost, I do truly believe, in all honesty, she's the definition of one of the best powerhouse women and trailblazers in the last 100 years. She is personally credited for shaping the role of the First Lady. And in fairness she had a lot of time to do so. Her husband, FDR, was the longest serving president for 12 years before we had term limits. So she had, you know, 12 years to really kind of carve out what the role should be. But she made the first lady post one of servitude and philanthropic focus, and it didn't have that kind of impression before she took office. You know, the other thing that I like about her is she's also very controversial. She was known for being outspoken, especially on her views, on her racial views. She was the first presidential spouse to actually hold a press conference, and people were shocked when she declared one. She wrote a syndicated newspaper column, and she would speak at national conventions. So she was, I mean, think about when she was doing this. This was like in the 1930s to the 1940s. She was, by virtue of her first lady title, she kind of, in fairness, demanded that the media pay attention to her because of the title. And because of that, she actually created an environment where people then started to cover the first lady and started to respect the role and take it seriously. The other thing she did, which was a surprise, and I don't do this with you, but rarely she did publicly disagree with her husband's policies. Again, being very outspoken, she was a very outspoken advocate for expanded roles for women in the workplace, civil rights for African Americans and Asian women and Asian Americans, and the rights of World War II refugees. Now remember, she was doing this 60 years ago when outspoken women were just not a norm.
Talking 1940s, when women didn't have the support in the media, frankly, the media was different than it is now. Public really wasn't used to a woman being so independent or outspoken.
And she was also very active after she left the White House. So what I loved about her as well is you look at the Hillary Clintons of the world and other women politicians who've kind of followed in their husband's footsteps. That was really carved out by Eleanor Roosevelt. After she left the White House, and actually after her husband died, she pressed the United States to join and support the United Nations. She was actually one of the UN's first delegates from the U.S. She was the first chair of the UN Commission on Human Rights. Think about that. She was the first chair for the UN Commission on Human Rights, and she oversaw the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as well. Later, she also chaired the John F. Kennedy administration's Presidential Commission on the Status of Women. By the time she died, she was regarded as one of, quote, one of the most esteemed women in the world. She was also called the object of the most universal respect in the New York Times obituary on her. In 1999, she was also ranked 9th in the top 10 of Gallup's list of most widely admired people in the 20th century.
And I had a sneaking suspicion you'd go with Eleanor Roosevelt because of two favorite quotes that you use with our kids are from her.
You know mine, right? Number one, my favorite Eleanor quote to our daughter, quote, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent.
I love that. I love that. And I also love, quote, learn from the mistakes of others. You can't live long enough to do them on your own. You can't live long enough to do them on your own, end quote.
Yeah, but, you know, I do think that our children are trying to test that theory.
So my favorite Eleanor Roosevelt quote is, women are like tea bags. They don't know their true strength until they're in hot wangs.
Really? I don't think that quote is what you think it means.
I'm just saying. I've had the experience with hot water, hot coffee, all thrown at me. You boiling mad, you know.
Yeah, well, maybe you'll like another Eleanor quote. Quote, well-behaved women rarely make history. That's a true quote. Well-behaved women rarely make history.
I don't like that one. You know, she's also famous for saying anger is one letter short of danger, huh? What about that one?
Nice recovery. It sounds like we could write a Broadway musical script based off of Eleanor Roosevelt quotes alone. Well, folks, let's get back to the Women on 20's effort. To cast your vote for the $20 bill and one of the final four women, go to www.womenon20.org. Voting ends May 1st. They may extend it. That's all for our segment this week. Don't forget to download our podcast on iTunes Podcasts or stream free directly from our website or Blog Talk Radio as well. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Jay, any last words?
I like tea.
I think it's the hot water you prefer. We'll talk about that after this. Have a great week, everyone.